All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're in lesson number 21. This is our final lesson in the book of Numbers, and it's been a real good study. It really has been. As we pick up here in chapter 34, Moses has taken care of just about all the business, and last week, in last week's lesson, he dealt with taking care of the major part of what he needed to say. And now he's just ending up. And I've told you many times that Moses ended the book of Numbers very abruptly, just very abruptly. And I suppose it's because he knows that he needs to state the law again, to talk about the law. It's been 38 years since they've heard the law presented to them. And so he's going to lay down the pen on the book of Numbers, and he's going to pick up a pen and start writing out the book of Deuteronomy. And in doing so, he's going to pick up and he's going to move through all this same information again. Information that was in the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers. He's going to sum it all up, put some interesting detail into it that was not in Exodus, was not in Numbers, and yet wrap it in the stuff that was in Exodus and Numbers and also in Leviticus. And so today's lesson looks like it's three chapters. It looks like it's very long. However, we may get out real early today, so just hang on, because chapter 34 took me 4.5 minutes to do in the 8 o'clock class. So if you don't ask a lot of questions, I bet you we can get it done that fast. And there's not much to do, and I'll show you why. As Moses ties up the loose ends, he says, verse 1, Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Command the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land of Canaan, this is the land that shall fall to you as an inheritance, even the land of Canaan according to its borders. And from that, starting in verse 3, the Lord describes to Moses, who describes to the sons of Israel, the borders and the markers, what's called the meets and the bounds. You know, it's kind of interesting because even today, this past week, I helped with one of our attorneys in the church to check out the meets and the bounds for a deed that was being filed. And it was kind of interesting. It said from a metal half-inch metal stake on the corner of the road by the double gated fence, 50 paces north and so many feet, some kind of stuff like that. You turn west and you go so many feet and all this kind of stuff. And then to the middle of the creek where an oak tree is growing and on. And I'm thinking, okay. And Milt said, yeah, the problem is that the oak tree's been dead and gone for 75 years. So nobody exactly knows where that marker is. Well, the great part about how the Lord did all these boundary lines is he followed streams, he followed valleys, he followed mountains that were never going to move per se. You know, streams move a little bit, they move up and down, but that's what he's doing, he's following streams. So it says in the southern section here, it says, your southern section shall extend from the wilderness of Zin along the side of Edom, and your southern border shall extend to the end of the Salt Sea, that's the Dead Sea, eastward in. So let me just help you with that. Go to your map. We've got all these places. We could look them up. But if you look on the map, you see the black line that looks like a V at the bottom. Goes all the way down to the Sea of Aqaba and all the way up. Starts at the Dead Sea, goes down, comes back up to the Mediterranean Sea. I've got it here on the board sketched out too. This is the southern border that he is explaining in that passage. And then when you go to the next passage, he's going to talk about the western border. And the western border starts here at the, this comes in right at a little river called the Wadi Egypt, or the Egypt River. It's traditionally been the boundary of Israel for all these years. You go right up the coastline, and that blue there, it's also blue on your map there, that's the coastline, that's the western border of this part of the Promised Land. And then you come up to the north, and at the north it says you start here and you go over to Mount Hor. Well, Mount Hor was down here, but this is another Mount Hor that's up above. It actually has another name too, but you go straight over to it, and you start following the valley around the mountain edges, and it comes around to the Sea of Kinnereth, or what we call the Sea of Galilee. That's your northern border. And then you catch the Jordan River, the green, goes all the way down to the Dead Sea. That is the western part of the Promised Land. Now, we've already gotten the eastern part, everything on this side. We got Manasseh, we got Reuben, we got Gad. They've already gotten their land picked out for them. And so with that, we're through with chapter 34. Wasn't that quick? That's where we are. Not much there. Verse 13 does pick up. And he says to him in chapter 34, verse 13, he says, this is the land that you are to apportion by lot among you as a possession, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9.5 tribes. 9.5. Remember, 2.5 were on the other side. Now they've already gotten their land. Now we're going to get this land when you go over and they fight for it, which the Lord has commanded to give the 9.5 tribes. Verse 14 says, for the tribe of the sons of Reuben have received theirs according to their father's household, the tribes of the sons of Gad according to their father's household, and half the tribe of Manasseh have received their possession. And the 2.5 tribes have received their possession across the Jordan opposite of Jericho. That means on the other side of the Jordan, away from the city of Jericho, the Jordan River. Verse 16 says, then the Lord spoke to Moses and said, these are the names of the men who shall apportion the land for your inheritance. Who's in charge? When you go across, Moses is not going because he's going to die on Mount Nebo. Who's in charge? Well, it's Eleazar, the high priest, and it's Joshua who's taken Moses' place. So Eleazar and Joshua are going to be in charge when they get on the other side of the land, dividing up the land and saying, okay, Simeon, you're here. Judah, you're here. Issachar, the other half of the tribe of Manasseh, you're here. Benjamin, Naphtali, Asher, Zebulun, here's where your lands are. And so they're going to divide it up. And then, lo and behold, it says, you shall take one leader of every tribe to apportion it. So Zebulun, here's your leader. Reuben, this is your leader. In other words, and he starts giving those names of the tribe of Benjamin and Joseph and Manasseh and Ephraim. And all that. We get those names. That means one person in the tribe, then, as we've already discovered in a previous lesson, will select about 12 acres of land and give 12 acres of land to every man with inside their tribal area. You follow me? So Eleazar and Joshua say, okay, Naphtali, this is the borders of your little plot of land. Now divide that up amongst all the men, and they'll all get just almost 12 acres. Not quite 12, but almost 12 acres, and away they go. So with that, we pick up in verse 1 of chapter 35. It says, now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the city. And the city shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture land shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for their beasts. Okay. So now we have to remember, we've got all these this tribe of Levi, the Levites, we call them. Now there's among the Levites, there's the Gershites, there's the Merarites, and there's the Kohaths. And these people are all of the priestly line. They're of the minister line, and they are not allowed to own land. Their land has to be donated to them for them to live on, but it's not their land. They're using it free of charge, but they do not have a possession in the land of Israel. And so the Lord says to those who get the land, the different tribes, Manasseh, Gad, Reuben, whatever, says, you're going to establish some cities. And outside of these cities, you're going to give some land for the ministers to live on and for them to keep the herds and flocks that they have, also for their family to provide for their income. So all of y'all do not have to keep, you tribal folks, Zebulun and Naphtali and all those, you don't have to keep feeding these ministers. They feed themselves. You give to the temple, and the temple gives to them to feed them because they're priests. So what happens with that, and Leviticus chapter 25 actually covers that. We won't go there because we kind of get the whole gist of it here. Verse 4 says this, the pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall extend from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits. And you shall also measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits. So you're going to get a, you're going to go out 2,000 cubits, but for the first 1,000 cubits, that first 1,500 feet, by the way, that's how far it is, 1,500 feet, is going to be for the where the Levites are going to pitch their tents and build their houses, and that's where they're going to live. And then the next 1,000 cubits, or the 1,500 feet, I should say, that's they're going to use that as pasture lands. So all around the city, you have Levites living right up next to the city. So that means if you're going to visit a city, and you're leaving one city, and you're leaving your city, not villages, we're not talking about that, we're talking about cities now, big complexes, big organizations, big towns, I should say that. To leave town, you got to go right through the any direction you go, you've got to go right through where the Levites live, and then you've got to cross their pasture lands, and then out to the city you go. And let's see, you're going into a city, you got to go through the pasture lands of the Levites, and then through the living areas of the Levites before you get to the wall of the city to go into the city to do trades. And so that's just the way it was. And so that's the way it is. And so they get to have this. They get to have this land. It becomes theirs to pasture. It becomes theirs to live on. But they don't own it. They don't own it at all. It belongs to the tribes of that area. Because the Levites are spread out all over the promised land. They're the ministers. So therefore, Levi owns no land. Verse 6. The cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be, and you're going to get six to begin with. You're going to get more, but you're going to get six. Six cities of refuge, which you shall give for the manslayer to flee to. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. Okay, so we have 42 cities going to the Levites. We have six cities going to the Levites. We have 48 cities. These are not the small little villages here and there where 100 people live here. These are cities. Remember, we've got 601,550 men who are soldiers with all of their families, parents, kiddos, and everything. We've got a, so when you add that up, we've probably got 3 million, 4 million people, something like that. And they're going to grow in number. You know, they're not going to get smaller. They're going to get larger. And so we've got some major cities that are going to be selected. And six of those cities are going to be for cities of refuge where a manslayer can go live. What's a manslayer? Someone who has intentionally killed someone or accidentally killed someone. Either way, you're considered a manslayer. And whenever you have killed someone, you can run to one of these six cities of refuge, get inside the wall, and you are safe until the high priest and the congregation of that city has rendered judgment on you, whether you are guilty or you are innocent. Verse 7. All the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities together with their pasture lands. As for the cities which you shall give for the possession of the sons of Israel, you shall take more from the larger, and you shall take less from the smaller. Each shall give some of his cities to the Levites in proportion to his possession which he inherits. In other words, the number of ministers who are going to be in your area to minister to you depends on how big your tribe is. How many people are there? Where there are more people, then you're going to have more ministers. They're going to take more of that 3,000 feet up. If you have a smaller number, your city is smaller, not as many ministers, they're going to take up less of that land. By the way, if there were not enough Levites to possess the entire land in that 3,000 feet going out, then other people, the tribes, could use it. And by the way, on top of that, which we'll get to in just a minute, the Levites, every 50 years, had to return it to its original owners, of which then the original owners would turn right around and divvy it up to the Levites again for another 50 years for their ministers to have a, place. I don't know. It may have been like the Methodist Church where every 50 years they swap ministers for a new place. It's moving day, time to swap, or something like that. I don't know how it worked. No one knows how it works. Not even the Jews know how it works. But somehow they give it back. Looking on, here in the scripture it says, verse 9, says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourselves cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there." That means an accidental killing. "These cities shall be as refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. The cities which you are to give shall be your six cities of refuge. You shall give three cities across the Jordan and three cities on the land of in the land of Canaan, and they are to be cities of refuge." And so if we look on the board, I've done this. On this side of the Jordan River, there are going to be three cities of refuge. Boom, boom, boom. On this side of the Jordan, three cities of refuge. Middle, a high, middle, and low. A person accidentally or intentionally kills someone. He runs to the city of refuge, and there he is safe until the trial has happened. Everybody with me? Anybody got any questions so far? Okay. Verse 15. Now he splits it up for when a person, a manslayer, a person has killed someone, does it with intent. "These six cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel. Also for the alien and for the sojourner among them." In other words, these are cities of refuge, and it doesn't matter if you're Jewish. It doesn't matter if you're from Babylon. It doesn't matter where you're from. You can just be a traveler passing through who has defended himself against hoodlums. Y'all know what hoodlums are? Against hoodlums to a try, and one died, then you, be whether you be Jew or from India or from just a passerby on a trade route or something like that, you will immediately go as fast as you can to a city of refuge until you can stand trial. Verse 16. He says this. "If he struck him down with an iron object," that means like an axe or sword, "so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death." Sounds like a death penalty, doesn't it? Okay. Verse 17. "If he struck him down with a stone in his hand, by which he will die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. And the murderer shall surely be put to death." Verse 18. "If he struck him down with a wooden object in his hand by which he might die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer, and the murderer shall surely be put to..." Now let me just pause here for just one commercial. When you hear someone say to you that the Bible does not support the death penalty, I would say they probably have not read the Bible. And for those of you who are with me within Exodus and also in Numbers, whether you like the death penalty or not, the death penalty is in the Bible for certain things. By the way, I think you're going to be happy with the way this turns out, though, if you do not like the death penalty. If you do not like the death penalty, there were some rules that you could follow if you were actually innocent, found innocent, or did not have enough witnesses, that all you had to do was follow the rules and you didn't get the death penalty. So the Lord even covers that. We'll find that as we go here. All right. So it goes on to say, verse 19, "The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. If he pushed him of hatred, or threw something at him lying in wait, and as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer, and the blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. In other words, if a person kills somebody and they do it with intent, they do it with a deadly object, they do it with an object that they know, if they hit them with it, it is going to probably kill them and they die, they are considered a murderer. And the blood avenger, once they have been found guilty, the blood avenger will kill them when he comes to them. Who is the blood avenger? The blood avenger is any male relative of the person who died that is a family member of the blood of the same family. So let's say that a person who killed someone was from the tribe of Gad, from the family of Imri. Did you catch that one? From the family of Imri. You know, we have a minister on staff named Imri Gad. He happens to be my boss. So I can pick on him with... Well, I may not be able to pick on him. Let's pick somebody else. Anyway, from the family of Imri. So one of Imri's family members has killed someone. And they've gone before the congregation. They've gone, and the high priest is there. And they have been found with multiple witnesses that this person did in fact kill someone, and that the death penalty was imposed on them because they did it with intent to kill him. Then Imri, a blood relative, would be the one, or could be the one, who would go and kill that person. Execute that person, let's put it that way. It could be any male relative. And by the way, it could be any person of the tribe of Gad because they're all related. In other words, you follow me? Any person could be the person who does the execution. Now, let's look on because we've got more information about that. It says, but if he pushed him suddenly without enmity. In other words, you know, it's not intending to, but he's just mad at him, okay? And or threw something at him without lying in wait. Just mad. I don't know about y'all, but I had an eighth grade history teacher that he would get mad at us for some reason. And believe me, he had lots of reasons to get mad at my eighth grade class in history with him. I mean, because we didn't listen or whatever. He would turn around and he would grab an eraser off the board and chunk it at you just because he was mad. We were glad that it was an eraser. We're just glad. Until one time in show and tell, this girl had brought, you know how in history you have to build stuff out of paper mache and stuff like that. She had brought in some real bricks and cover them, and he grabbed one of those and started to throw it. And we all went, no, because he was going to throw it. Well, the eraser's just his nature. It's not meaning anything. It doesn't hurt anything. But if he had picked up that brick and thrown it, that's a whole different ballgame. You follow me? Because he should have felt that weight. He should have thrown that weight. It had some intent on it, even though it probably would have been accidental. Okay? He says if he threw something to him without lying in wait, that means he's not there waiting for him to come by. Okay? It's not something where he's intending to do something. Verse 23, or with any deadly object of stone, or without seeing it dropped on him so that he died, while he was not his enemy or seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to those or these ordinances. In other words, the blood avenger is the family member who's saying, look, we need to do something about this person because they killed my son, they killed my daughter, they killed my uncle, they killed someone. And so you've got this person out there who's pushing for this trial. And he's followed the person who killed someone to the city of refuge, and he knew that once he got inside the gate of the city of refuge, he had no authority to do anything to that person until after the trial. Verse 25 says this, the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger. In other words, if it is not with intent, then that person is going to go free. He is going to live. So in other words, there's no death penalty here. So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was appointed with the holy oil. Time out. The guy accidentally kills someone. He runs to the city of refuge. He ends up getting put in jail, but he's safe there. Nobody's going to harm him. He goes before the congregation. The high priest is there. They find him not guilty. They let him out of jail, but he cannot leave the city of refuge. He must stay there. If the priest, high priest, at the point in time that he is convicted outlives him, he will never leave the city of refuge. But if the high priest dies, let's say they put him in jail, and a month later the high priest dies. Now what happens? But if the man let's just back up. He's got to stay in that city. Verse 26 says, but if the manslayer at any time goes beyond the border of his city of refuge to which he may flee, and guess what? That blood avenger finds him outside the borders of the city of refuge, and the blood avenger kills the manslayer. In other words, he's outside the border. I can kill him. He was not supposed to leave the city. He was fine to live out his life inside the borders, but he's outside the border. And the blood avenger caught him outside and he kills him. Guess what happens to the blood avenger? He will not be guilty of the blood. In other words, the blood avenger has every right to do that. Because he should have remained in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Good. So let's say that the person is guilty. He's living in the city. And 60 days later, the high priest dies. What happens? But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return to the land of his possession. These things shall be for a statutory ordinance to you throughout your generations and all your dwellings. So, if you outlive the high priest, you get to go home. And no one can touch you. You're free. So that's the city. That's the statue. That's the ordinance that Moses leaves with them about someone who kills someone. Verse 30 says, if anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, plural. But no one shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Takes more than one. So the person has killed someone. He knows he's killed someone. He runs to the city of refuge. And only one eyewitness shows up to testify against him. He goes free. Time out. He goes free to live in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest, if he outlives the high priest. You follow me? So he's still, when you've changed your life when you kill someone. You've changed your life inside the nation of Israel. When you kill someone, you've changed your life for the rest of your life in that situation. Now, interesting, verse 31 says this. Moreover, Moses has thought through this. You shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. What in the world does that mean? Well, remember this. Remember that every firstborn of a family, that be it a lamb, a goat, a ram, a bull, or a child, was to be given to the temple. However, the human child was to be ransomed. In other words, was a tribute or a tax was to be paid so that the child was not to be put to death. They were not going to put a human to death. It's against the laws of the Levitical laws and against the laws of Moses to put someone to death. Not supposed to. Now they're going to sacrifice the lamb. They're going to sacrifice the ram. They're going to sacrifice a bull. They're going to sacrifice an ox. They're going to sacrifice a goat. But for a little firstborn baby, they're not going to sacrifice that baby. That baby's going to be ransomed with a price. A price. By the way, that's theology that's going to flow out through the rest of the scriptures. He goes on to say, you shall not take a ransom for him who has fled to this city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. In other words, you can't pay a bond. You can't pay a bail. You cannot pay off the city to let someone who is guilty and has a death penalty on them go home free. You can't use money in any way, form, or fashion to pay off anyone with a ransom for that person to not be guilty of murdering someone. Verse 33 says, so you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. In other words, if someone kills someone, you have polluted the land. And the only thing that can make that land right is the blood being shed of the one who did the killing. Anything else is defilement of the land. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, the Lord says, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. Mercy me. So Moses just tidies that up just a little bit. Pretty strong restrictions. And then lo and behold, in the last chapter of the book of Numbers, chapter 36, Moses has one more thing he has to deal with before he looks on to restating the law in the book of Deuteronomy. It comes up like this. The heads of the families, family of Manasseh, have figured out a loophole in the instruction concerning those five girls who had no male that could accept a plot of land for them to live on in the new promised land. And if you remember, they went to Moses and said, hey, we don't have a male to accept our land. We're five girls. Why are we going to be left out with no place to stay? And Moses came back and he gave them an instruction. Well, now we're 30 days, 40 days, 50 days after that instruction was given. And lo and behold, the Manassans have found a loophole. And they have to question Moses about it. And so the heads of the father, the household of the family of the sons of Gilead, the son of Milcar, the son of Manasseh, the family of the sons of Joseph came near. And they spoke before Moses and before the leaders, the heads of the father's household of the sons of Israel. And they said, the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land by lot to the sons of Israel as an inheritance. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance to Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. Zelophehad, if you remember, is dead. They had no father. He had no sons. Verse 3. But if a married one of the sons of another tribe of the sons of Israel, let's say they don't marry someone from the tribe of Manasseh, they marry someone from the tribe of Reuben, or they marry someone from the tribe of Issachar, they marry someone from another tribe, okay? Their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe of which they belong. Thus, it will be withdrawn from our lot. In other words, we belong here in the land, the tribal area of Manasseh, which, by the way, half of it's right there marked. The other half's going to be right on the other side, just below the Kinnereth Sea, or we call it the Sea of Galilee. And so these five girls marry, so let's say one marries someone from the tribe of Judah, one marries someone from the tribe of Simeon, and that was all legal. They could all marry within the tribes, but now we've got a problem because we're giving five women five plots of land that they can live on as if they were men. But when they die, that land would go to their husbands. And if they've married someone from the tribe of Judah, someone from the tribe of Issachar, someone from the tribe of Naphtali, someone from the tribe of Simeon, someone from the tribe of Asher, when they die, their husbands get their land, and their Asherites or Naphtaliites or Judites or whatever, now Judah, this way down here in the south, is going to own a little plot of land right up in here, but their plot of land's down here. This is their tribal area. So, Moses, this doesn't make sense, because then as this plot here becomes theirs, we get all this intermarrying going on, and it's like chicken pox up here. Where's your tribal area? Well, we've got land here, and also we've got land up on the Hermon River right outside of Dallas. And you come down the Trinity to about cut and shoot. And we got another little plot there. That was from that girl that we, you know, we married into that, married her into that family. And I said, we can't do this. Because then every 50 years, when the land all goes back to the family, it goes back to the family every 7 years, then it resets every 50 years, according to the year of Jubilee. Now we've really got problems. How are we going to do this? So Moses thinks about it. And the Lord commanded, this. He says, let me pick up. Did we get verse 4 in there? I don't think we got verse 4, did we? We missed verse 4? It says, okay. When the Jubilee, that's the 50 year the sons of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. So their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of the tribes of their father. So it's just, the land is gone, that plot of land. You're marching across Manasseh's land, and all of a sudden you're on Reuben's land for 12 acres, and then you're back in Manasseh's land. It's just not a smart thing to happen. So verse 5 says, so Moses commanded the sons of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, the tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statement. They have found a loophole, in other words. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they wish. That's a pretty good statement. Let them marry whom they wish. I'm sure when the tribe of Manasseh heard that phrase, they went, "Rrr." And then Moses goes on to say, only they must marry within the family of the tribe of their father. In other words, they can marry whoever they wish. I think about like this. Went to the zoo one time, and there's a big old mama gorilla. Mama gorilla out there laying down with her eyes closed. And she has a baby gorilla. And she's holding on to the rear end hair of the baby gorilla. And she's asleep. And you watch her as the baby gorilla's moving along around. And she's just holding on to that baby gorilla. Baby climbing behind her, moving around. That baby can go any place that baby wants to go at the end of mama's arm. You got it? That's what Moses is saying here. You can select any man you want to select, but he's got to be from the tribe of Manasseh. Got it? So, thus, no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his father. And every daughter who comes into possession of an inheritance of any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be wife to ones of the family of the tribe of her father, so that the sons of Israel, which each may possess the inheritance of his father. One more verse here. Thus, no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for the tribe of the sons of Israel shall each hold to his own inheritance. You know, I have thought many times, God could have sure used me back in the days of Moses to straighten this up and make it simple. Because it's just not. It's just not. But it's the Hebrew way of saying things. In other words, Moses is saying, all right, just as these five girls must marry within the tribe, any time in the future, if a woman finds herself as the sole heir of her father's land or brother's land or family land, and she's not married yet, then she must marry someone within her own tribe so that whenever she dies, the land stays in the tribal area. Follow me? That's all that said. And believe me, I went around the world with the Lord talking about what that said, thinking, Lord, you sure could have made that easier. He said to me, oh, that was Moses' doing. I don't know anything about that. I'm just kidding you. Verse 10 says, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so the daughters of Zelophehad did. Maha, Tezra, Holga, Milka, Noah, and the daughters of the sons of Zelophehad married their uncle's sons. Because remember, they had to get away a little bit because they've got a Levitical law of how close they can marry, because that marrying sisters and brothers came to an end 38 years before. Now, in the whole world, they're still marrying brothers and sisters. And you think about that when you get on down another 1,400 years and you've got Cleopatra marrying her real brother, Ptolemy the seventh, or whatever. You go, you know, you just do it. And then you see all across the world, brothers and sisters are marrying to keep the royal line clean. I don't think it kept it clean. I think it messed it up, if you really want to know. But that was common. Only in the Jewish realm had the Lord put a moratorium on how close you could marry a relative. And by the way, you pretty much have to get out to third cousins to be able to marry a relative in the Levitical law, which is pretty much where you see it now, unless you live in one of those states where they marry second cousins and, you know, that type of stuff that happens. Don't think a thing about it. No, they don't. So these girls, these five women, they marry their uncle's sons. There's father's brother's sons. Got it? So they're marrying second cousins. There's a reason for that. It's because actually it's their uncle is their great uncle in this situation, because Zelophehad had no brothers. So you have to go back one more generation. And in the Jewish line, anyone back, any generation back, was considered brothers. Okay. So they married those who are the family of the sons of Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, and their inheritance remained with the tribes of the family of their fathers. And I got to thinking when I thought this, when did they marry? Did they just leave Moses and say, okay, we'll marry within Manasseh, and they went out and found somebody, fell in love, and got married right then? Or did they wait? If they waited more than 60 days, Moses didn't write this passage. Joshua had to write it, because Moses is going to be dead soon. So somehow someone helped us with that and got written in here that these five girls agreed to live, to marry someone from their tribe, and they did so. Well, with that, Moses is through with this part. And he says, these are the commandments and the ordinances which the Lord commanded to the sons of Israel through Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. They're 10 miles from Jericho. Jericho's going to be their first battle. They're going to cross over the Jordan River. They're going to take that Ark of the Covenant. They're going to have it out there. The priests are going to be carrying it. And as soon as the front priest touches his toe to the Jordan River, it's going to stop flowing, and they're going to cross over on dry ground. I can just imagine Joshua saying, well, Moses, you thought you did a big deal with the Red Sea. We got to do it with the Jordan. And they do. As soon as that toad touches the Jordan River, it stops flowing. In fact, it stops flowing long enough for them to go gather 12 large stones and build a memorial of the crossing right in the middle of the Jordan River, of which in the New Testament times, 1,400 to 1,500 years later, the New Testament writers say, and those stones are still there to this day. But they hadn't crossed the Jordan yet. In fact, Moses ends with verse 13. It just simply says, these are the instructions that I'm giving to you since we arrived right here at the plain of Moab, which is 5 miles square by 5 miles square, 25 square miles, and they are living there. And this camp is huge, huge. It is true. Go out here on the highway and drive down to the first exit in League City, and that's how deep the camp was. Now turn that sideways and make it 5 miles wide and 5 miles deep. That's how much land it took for this nation of Israel to camp with all the people and with all the cattle. And Moses says, here it is. These are the instructions I give to you while we're here at this camp by the Jordan River. And so the book of Numbers ends abruptly. But Moses has more to say. And he's going to pick it up in Deuteronomy. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the question is, so everybody can hear it, is do they still have to use the this tribe? Are you talking about when Moses is going to cross it, when they're going to cross it, or are you talking about today?
I'm talking about when they
cross. When they cross the river, yes. They must, well, okay. The camp where they are camping right now is going to be the camp where the majority of the women and the children and the animals are going to stay until they go across the Jordan River and they make a swath almost all the way to the Mediterranean Sea and they capture that land. Then they'll move their Jericho and Ai. Okay. Then they'll move their children and everything in as they capture. Okay. So the women will stay behind. And yeah, this is the war thing. When they move the camp, and they move the ark and the tabernacle and everything, the answer is yes. It's the same order they always are to move in, always. Now, today, they don't even know who's Jews of what tribe or whatever, but the Lord does. And by the way, we're going to get into that in the next study because there's 144,000 that are still taken care of. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this time to serve and to worship you and to study your word. What a great book the book of Numbers is. We thank you for allowing Moses to write it for our edification, and we thank you for the great things that we've learned with inside of it that spin out into the future. And Lord, thank you that you are our God that we can depend on and a God we can trust. We love you in your name. Amen and amen.